Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 136, God Optional. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And in our continuing series on God, we thought it would be interesting to talk to somebody who's part of a Jewish movement that doesn't believe in God, the secular humanistic Jewish movement. Our guest today, Judith Seid, has rabbinical ordination from the International Institute for Secular Humanistic Judaism. A couple of years ago, we spoke with the dean of that institute, Rabbi Adam Shalom. Judith Seid is the author of a book called God Optional Judaism, Alternatives for Cultural Jews Who Love Their History, Heritage, and Community, recently reissued in a revised and expanded edition by Blue Thread Press, an imprint of Jewish Currents magazine. Judith Seid is also the author of We Rejoice in Our Heritage, Home Rituals for Secular and Humanistic Jews, and she is the editor of Understanding Secular Humanistic Judaism. Judith Seid is the founder of the Baltimore Jewish Cultural Chavura and Tri-Valley Cultural Jews in Northern California. In addition to rabbinical ordination from the secular humanistic movement, she also holds a master's degree in Jewish communal studies from Hebrew Union College. She has taught in and directed several secular Jewish supplemental schools and directed the Ann Arbor Jewish Cultural Society for many years. We're looking forward to this conversation about the subject of God when you don't believe in God. So Judith Seid, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's great to have you.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here.
We're really excited to have your perspective in this series on God. I wanted to start by asking you a little bit about a statement that you make in the book, which is that you say, we're not obsessed with the non-existence of gods. They are irrelevant to us. And you go on to say, our important theological statement is not that there is no God, but that no God is our authority. I was wondering if you could go into a little bit more of an understanding of what you're trying to say there. And also, I was curious if you could help us start to understand a little bit, what does spirituality mean in that context? What does a secular spirituality really mean?
We, as secular humanistic Jews, don't believe that there are any supernatural forces that affect our world in any way, or that we should be consulting in deciding what kinds of things we want to do in our life. The spirituality thing, I have to laugh because for a long time, we referred to that as the S word. That was something that we were not interested in, not talking about. It had this terrible connotation for us as being something that was taking us away from the real world, our Weltlich, which is the Yiddish term for secular humanistic Jew, means worldly. And we thought it was taboo. And then in the last maybe 30 years, there has been a feeling that this is a natural human feeling, this feeling of being connected to something outside ourselves, inside ourselves, part of ourselves. And that's our feeling of spirituality, the kind of thing that you can get when you sing. Singing is how I do it. You know, when I sing with you, in 1 minute, I love you. But some people get this from nature, from art. And then there's also the feeling that you get this, the feeling of being congruent with your authentic self. When you are doing something that you intensely believe in and just feels right to you, you have that same feeling of being connected, of being congruent. And I think congruence is the word that I would use to describe what we mean by a secular spirituality.
Can you help us understand a little bit more deeply what secular humanistic Judaism is about, in the sense that, and you talk about this in your book, that there are secular people who basically say, you know, I'm just not that interested in Judaism, right? I want to just, you know, I understand that I'm just kind of done with that. And then you talk about sort of secular Jews or secular Judaism that's an attempt to try to build a Judaism that works without a belief in God. And I guess I'm curious about how do you take something that was sort of constructed in an environment in which God was very central and that many elements of it are about God, and how do you kind of reimagine that to work either without a God or to be, as you say, God optional, while retaining, let's say, the thickness of what was built up around God, you know? Or is it more that you have to just kind of lay those elements aside and focus on the other parts?
Okay, I'm going to argue with your major premise, which I think is faulty. And that is that it is actually about God. And I don't think that's true. The God stuff got overlaid on a lot of things. Things got poured into God vessels. I'm going to read you my favorite quote from Horace Kallen, whom I love. And he says, "Judaism consists of the coming together and the moving apart of great numbers of diverse and contradictory items of thought, feeling, and conduct. Each and every one of these items has a claim upon the consideration of every Jew." And so what that means to me is that the civilizations that Jews have created, like most civilizations, have included some religion in them. Ours, because we didn't have land, we had language for languages. So what was kind of left in modern times, if you didn't have language and land, was religion. But there's so much that has been called religious that's not really religious. It's really who we are as an ethnos, as a people. Until the Second World War, more American Jews were affiliated with secular organizations than religious. They were members of Workman's Circle or one of the other school movements. They were members of Landsmannschaften, which are hometown societies. They were involved in all sorts of Jewish things. And then after World War II, we became a religious community and not an ethnos because we were all going to be Americans. I think we're in a funny time now in which people are reclaiming ethnic identity. So we have this kind of ebb and flow of ethnicity and what people are claiming and how they are feeling themselves. And there seems to be some connection among all Jews, born Jews, not born Jews. There's some kind of feeling of connection. We're maybe not part of the same tribe, but we're part of the same people.
I've been really interested to hear you talk about the secular humanistic Jewish movement as a thing that's been around for hundreds of years, because I think that a lot of us who encounter the movement encounter it with a story that Sherwin Wein was a rabbi of a Reform synagogue in the Detroit area, and he realized or decided or, you know, felt that there was not a God, and he sort of reshaped that synagogue into the mother synagogue of secular humanistic Judaism, and it's a relatively new movement. And you've kind of brought those two together and talked about the secular Jewish world that emerged in Europe, I guess, around the time of the Enlightenment and thereafter, and that, you know, we sort of think of as some of it went to Israel and some of it was destroyed in the Holocaust. And in America, it didn't really take root too much, although did in the first wave of immigration because of certain elements of America where religion was emphasized and was needed to sort of gain a foothold in America. But you've connected these two things, that sort of world of secular Jews and the movement that has to do with synagogues and rabbis that I think we see as Sherwin Wein as having launched. And so could you tell us a little bit more about the history of secular humanistic Judaism so that we can have a better understanding of that?
Sure, but let me not go all the way back to the beginning. Let me just start in the 1900s in America. By the first or second decade of the 1900s, there were four different branches of secular Judaism. Some of them were Hebrew-speaking, some of them were Yiddish-speaking, some of them were communist, some of them were just plain old Linke, leftist. And these were self-conscious movements in Jewish life, self-conscious secular movements in Jewish life. they didn't have rabbis. And because of that, after World War II, they did not have legitimacy. Well, partly it was McCarthy. But in America, you have to have rabbi before your name to have legitimacy, which is another reason that I went ahead and earned the title. But I'm not the one who put those together. In the early 1960s, when we were recovering from McCarthy, the secular Jewish groups all over the country got together. The only one that had survived of the four original was Workman Circle, Arbeiterring, and they survived by being anti-communist. But the rest of us had fallen apart from movements. It was just dangerous. And so in the early 1960s, Harold Gales called a meeting. He got in touch with many secular groups and called them together into what has become the Congress of Secular Jewish Organizations. About that time was the time when Sherwin started Humanistic Judaism. And Sherwin and Harold lived within a few miles of each other. They're both Detroit-based. And they talked, and we worked together. The secularist movement and the humanist movement worked together. And our big project together is our institute. And the idea that we need to say secular humanistic rather than just secular or just humanistic. We are too small to be divided by how we came to what we are. That said, I will say that the secular movement and the humanistic movement are different in certain ways, but that when secular Jews go to a community, if they move to a community, they join whatever's there. If it's a humanistic group, fine. If it's a secularist group, fine. And we feel pretty comfortable in that.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the kind of alternative to worship that happens in secular humanistic congregations? Like, can you help us understand a little bit, what does it look like in a secular humanistic congregation versus, you know, you can more easily understand a person who's a secular Jew, particularly one who has a family background and they move to a particular town and it has a secular group like the Workman Circle, you can say, oh, yeah, so you would just join that because it's a kind of group that shares your interests. But if you think about a secular congregation, that might actually be a very different experience from one that a person who was more from something like the Workman Circle would be used to, because it has a lot of the kind of trappings of congregational life. You know, it's not worship of God, but it's still perhaps built on a similar mold, right? That you come there on Shabbat and you do various things communally together, singing, etc. I imagine that the rabbi might give a sermon. You know, those are not necessarily the ways of being Jewish that somebody might have experienced if they had grown up in a more traditional, so to speak, secular Jewish institution like the Workman Circle.
Yeah, you're completely right. If I go to a humanist congregation, it's not a good cultural fit for me to sit in a space and to listen to a sermon. When I go to other secular communities, we tend not to call them congregations, but communities, I feel a better cultural fit. Our philosophy is the same. Our culture is a little bit different, although many of the humanistic communities don't have rabbis and function much more like the secular communities. Yeah, we get together on Shabbos and we light some candles and we sing some songs and we share challah and wine and then we hang out. On holidays, we have a more formal program. I have never given a sermon in my life, and I'm not likely to. I'm not that kind of rabbi. I am not the one who does the thinking for you and tells you what to believe. I'm the kind who goes and finds poetry, who goes and finds, you know, translations from Yiddish that I can use. I'm mostly the song leader.
I really appreciate a lot of what has come up so far, and I want to name just a few terms that I think are worth diving deeper on. On the one hand, we've got religious and secular, which I think is really important to look at further. And on the other, we also have religion related, obviously. And with Callan, with Horace Callan, we have the idea of cultural pluralism, of culture, of multiculturalism. That's sort of his pioneering idea that that you alluded to with quoting him. And so it actually brought me back a few years because I was transformed by many of the classes I took in college. But one of the classes I took in college that transformed me most was called Religion and Culture.
Tell about that.
Yeah. And so we really, it was sort of an introduction to religious anthropology. They probably didn't want to call it that because it would have gotten fewer signups. But basically, we read some big thinkers about sort of what religion is and how it operates and what culture is and how maybe and what secular means and what religious means and all these things. And what I came away thinking most from that class were a few things. One, the realms, the idea that religion, on the one hand, is one realm where like belief lives, belief, ideology, philosophies of God. The idea that that is one realm, and then culture, on the other hand, is sort of communal practices and rituals and food and whatever. Like the idea that those are separate, and that that when something mostly is operating in the sense of community or culture, it's not religious because it's sort of not focused on God. To me, I walked away from that class thinking that it's not that simple. And likewise, that those elements of us that are focused on belief, on God, on whether God is there or not there, or what God is, are not sheerly about belief, but also about the cultures we're in and the societies we're part of, etc. And so I came away with this big blurring. And ultimately, if I'm going to be totally honest, it made me struggle with communities that define themselves thoroughly as one or the other. So when I came across shortly after that secular humanistic Judaism, my initial reaction was, you know, I agree with the vast majority of premises here. The fact that God is not the central purpose. I liked what you said before. It's not about, you know, actively disbelieving God. It's just God's not the core thing. I liked that. But the sort of fact of secular right there at the top was really difficult for me because I don't really see myself as like unreligious. I see what I do as a kind of religion where God is not centralized, and I see that as neither secular nor religious. So I guess I wanted to bring that up, not because I think that where you're coming from is like inherently bad or wrong, but because I think it would be really valuable to hear more from you on what you and this movement is getting at with the idea that you are secular and that you are really excited to be focusing on a cultural kind of Judaism.
I think you're right that religion can be an integral part of culture. But people choose the pieces of their culture that they're interested in. And I think the difference with religion is that religion connotes authority. And that is what secular people reject, is authority. And our own movement was anti-clerical. I mean, really anti-clerical for the first 100 years, maybe 150 years of its existence. We only started ordaining leaders and rabbis because we needed somebody to do our weddings. I mean, we don't use rabbinic authority in the same way. I don't get to tell you what to do. I can teach, and I can help you judge. That's what I'm trained to do. I mean, religion is a part of many cultures. It influences other pieces of culture, and other pieces of culture influence religion. So I'm not saying that there isn't a place for religion, and I'm not arguing with somebody who is interested in religion. I'm just not interested in that piece of our culture.
Here's something that I want to sort of float by you. You don't have to accept my premise on this. I think the question will still work, but I think it might actually be a premise that you might agree with. But I want to connect it to what's going on in America today, where, in my view, we're seeing some of the institutions, the sort of authoritative institutions of America, like the Constitution, we're starting to see that they have less power, I think, than we thought they had. That and I think that one response to that could be a sort of anarchism or a sort of nihilism that might say, hey, the Constitution isn't working, so therefore sort of anything goes, right? And another type of reaction could be, hey, the Constitution isn't working in the authoritative way that we thought it was supposed to work, so therefore we have more responsibility to understand what we thought were the important principles of the Constitution, like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, et cetera, and we have to stand up for them even more strongly now that we understand that their authority isn't going to carry the day. And that's the piece that I'm struggling a little bit in terms of thinking about how we, you, whoever, right, as secular Jews, as kind of God optional, unsure kind of Jews, whatever, or very sure that there is no God type of Jews, how we might look at the material that had been presented to us and sort of retained by our culture over thousands of years using God language, right, using the language of authority. And my struggle is to say, what does it look like? And I'm curious, like, what does it look like, in fact, in secular humanistic Judaism? But I'm also interested to the extent that you think that secular humanistic Judaism hasn't quite gotten it right and there's more work to do, you know, what that work is. But how do we sort of take all of the material that has been packaged in God language and in the language of authority and not just kind of put it to the side, but also try to find ways to turn it secular in powerful ways?
I don't think anybody in any culture really thinks it's right to kick a dog. But we can say kindness to animals. We can say, for instance, we were slaves in Egypt. That's our language for expressing that you are not supposed to oppress the stranger. Other cultures have other language for expressing those same kinds of things. I don't think that all of this the religious development over, you know, 3,500 years and the different things that people have said, I don't consider it authority. I consider it our cultural language for expressing these kinds of pretty much universal values. At least I wish they were universal. Of course, we have some values that stink. We just don't choose those. And that's because the religion is not our authority. We have the freedom to say, yeah, I think that's great. That makes sense to me. My history tells me that, you know, we didn't like it when it was happening to us. Therefore, nobody would like it when it's happening to them. That makes sense to me. And I feel the same way about the U.S. Constitution. There are things in there that I wish were not authority. And a lot of people over the years have felt that way enough to make amendments to the Constitution.
I love the analogy to language and the question. So I think the question that I'm trying to get at is there are two options when a piece of language becomes problematic, right? The one that, for example, I think you talk about in your book that the Reconstructionist movement might take towards God is to redefine the word in such a way that for them it stops being problematic in the way that it was problematic for them, and now they can use it and, you know, problem solved. And, you know, I think that you say very helpfully in a few ways, you know, problem not solved. You know, number one, if you redefine God, which in the language had been seen as kind of an external entity with wishes and wills and commands, and now you're seeing God as some sort of force between all of us, you know, how can you still kind of ascribe the same will to that God? And so the language doesn't really work anymore. And I thought another amazing point that you made was that it's sort of not true to the martyrdom of our history in the sense that a lot of people died in order to not say things that they didn't believe when they were when people try to force them to convert to another religion. So why should we say things that we don't believe within Judaism? Because now we can with less harm to us. I thought that was a really important point. So that option is problematic, and you problematize it well. And the other option says, kind of, let's stop using this word. And I think the thing that I'm struggling with, especially when we recognize that so much, and I totally agree with you that not all and maybe not nearly all, but so much of our cultural material has this word in it. And that word is kind of bound up with all kinds of positive things. And as you say, all kinds of negative things, but let's focus on the positive. And we want to retain those positive things. How do we get rid of this word, God, and sort of not get rid of all the good things that it's attached to? And the thing that I guess that I feel like I've seen in many contexts or in many conversations with Jews, not the secular humanistic movement, but with Jews who say, you know, I'm a cultural Jew, is often what they're saying is something very, very thin, right? They're saying that means I, you know, like talking to Jews and I like eating certain foods, et cetera, which is fine. And I think that's really important. But I'm looking for a way to capture the ethical imperatives that used to be stated in God language and that aren't anymore. And how do we not lose those? And how do we create a thick Jewish culture that includes a strong sense of ethical imperative?
When we look at the word God in various things, or the word blessing in various things, we look then at what are we really talking about? What is the value here? And then for instance, we rejoice in our heritage. We rejoice in our heritage's home rituals for secular and humanistic Jews. And it's a book of what would have been blessings, but aren't. They are rituals, but they are not blessings. So instead of Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam, we say we rejoice in our heritage, which has given us the tradition. Or we rejoice in our heritage, which reminds us, because that's the authority we have, is our heritage and what we learn from our history. So we have these rituals that do the same thing for us that rituals do for religious people. I can sing the ashrays. I can sing the ashray, which means a rejoicing, over the wine, over the challah, over the candles. We have the Megillah, we have the Hanukkah candles, but we don't say God because we don't mean God. We say our heritage because that's what we are celebrating and looking to for how to make our ethical decisions.
I want to reflect more on the phrase God optional. We've used it in some other past conversations, but this is a great opportunity to really dig deep. So what I really appreciate is that the statement God optional is not no God, or it's very expansive and open to wherever people are on that. But what I haven't been able to learn yet is, what does it look like for those people who are secular humanistic Jews or in secular humanistic Jewish spaces? There are many that are not exercising the option to relate what they're doing to God. But by the sound of it, given the framing, there are some who are. But I'm really curious at what some of their conceptions of God might be. Because given that they're in this space that's very different from other kinds of Jewish spaces and where God plays a different role, I'm curious what it looks like when people in a God optional space do look to incorporate some form of God into what they're doing, but perhaps in a sense that's different from what God looks like elsewhere.
We do have people in our communities who have some sense that there's something out there, possibly a creator, possibly a benign presence. A lot of people come to our ceremonies, and they will come to our Pesach Seder, they will come to our Yom Kippur observance, and they will not notice that God isn't there. We are not, we don't go preaching, there's no God, there's no God, there's no God. It's okay if you want to think that there is a creator, if you want to think there's a benign force in the world, if you just have some kind of feeling that there should be some gods out there, it doesn't offend us in any way. But it's, you know, it's also not part of what we're doing. A lot of times I think that we have missed the point that one Jewish organization is not generally enough to fill every need of every member. You know, it's like if you're married to a person, that person does not have to fill every need you have. You know, you can go to the movies with somebody else who likes going to the movies. And I think it's the same thing in Jewish life. You can have your home community, but you can go elsewhere and find other experiences that that community doesn't provide.
If you were able to sort of foresee a development of secular Judaism in America, a thickening up, a flowering, the best possible scenario that you could imagine, what would that look like? You know, what types of things ought we be doing in this realm of Jewish life that we aren't currently doing or that aren't really working as well as we hope, and it could really become even better than it is now?
So much of this has to do with geography, and so much of the struggle has to do with the way that Jews don't have areas where Jews live anymore. When you live next to other Jews, around other Jews, it's so much easier. Where I live in the Far East Bay, 40 miles east of San Francisco, our distance, our geographical distance is so far that it is such a struggle for people even to bring their kids to Sunday school. It can take an hour to get to Sunday school. I wish I had a good answer for that question about how we can enrich Jewish life, especially in our secular Jewish life. We've got great stuff going on, but it's just so hard to get to it. And also soccer, you know, and music lessons and homework and all of the other things that are calling people, and political work. I'm unable to separate my Jewishness from my politics. To me, they're the same thing. And we have a lot of people who are engaged in political work who are not really thinking of this as their Jewish life. When I'm engaged in political work, for instance, that is my Jewish life. But in terms of enriching the life of Jews, I think we need to make the connections between what you're doing and what's Jewish. And I do want to say that we have really good luck with this. We have a great experience with this in our Brit Mitzvah programs. Because in our programs, we aim at trying to find the things in Jewish life that are interesting to the kids. So if they're interested in music, we make sure that they've got some kind of project that has to do with music. We had years ago when I was in Ann Arbor, there was one little girl. I sat down with her and I said, well, what are you interested in? And she told me shopping. And I thought, well, okay, I'm going to use this. You are interested in shopping. Here's a good project. Let's think about the material life of Jews over the years. What stuff did they have? Let's look at the Bible and see what stuff they had. Let's look at the Middle Ages and see what stuff they had and how they bought it and who made it and how it got to them. This is the kind of activity that I think is really important, is to integrate what you would call your real life, your normal life, your not Jewish life, with your Jewish life.
You know, it makes me think a little bit about what you were saying in your book about Buddhism being attractive to many Jews, right? That there are elements of Buddhism that you say that Buddhism provides to many Jews, to many people, a quote, meaningful atheism, you know, something that, this is another quote from you, answers the question of human suffering and the ultimate goal of existence. You know, but I think that you point out that Buddhism also often has elements that's about quieting your mind, whereas Judaism has often been about a lot of hubbub, a lot of activity, an active mind. So I wonder, though, if there are ways in a future form of secular Judaism, right, to sort of, as we have before in other iterations of Judaism, to sort of borrow from other cultures from other religions, and then to Judaize them, but there are ways in which they make profound changes in Judaism. So, for example, as I'm thinking about what you said in terms of our geographical dispersal, I'm thinking that there is this element of Judaism that a lot of folks insist is integral to Judaism, which is the communal dimension. And I wonder what it would look like to have an individual, maybe the future is a more individualistic Judaism, you know, one that's more able to be accessed through the internet, through reading, through personal contemplation, that's less dependent on being in a community of others. And we are starting to have the technology where Lex and I are playing around with it, right? We're starting to have the technology that potentially allows that to be effective, but it probably would not be as conducive to the sort of communal gatherings that we tend to think about. And it sort of strikes me that if we can imagine a Judaism without God, then perhaps we could imagine a Judaism with less emphasis on community. How does that land on you?
I'm fine with somebody inventing that. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to shul and I'm not going to the internet for my Jewishness. It's just not the Jewishness that I want. And I'm not going to take responsibility for inventing it. I'm good with you inventing it. I'm good with anybody who wants to be part of it. It's just not the way I want to be Jewish.
What we're gleaning from this conversation, I think, is that theoretically we were here in a God unit. But because of the nature of your movement and your work, conversation about God, or more specifically about God optional, is not independent from our conversations about us as human beings, as Jews, etc. And what I think is so interesting is the ways in which the three of us conceptualize community. Because I think that I get the sense that they're very different, because I realized a few years ago that I don't think I personally have a need for Jewish community. I don't think I have a need for have a weekly or regular rhythm where I'm with a particular set of the same people or same kinds of people around Jewishness or Judaism. I do have a need for Jewish me, and I do have a need for community. And often it's very convenient and kills two birds with one stone to do Jewish community, because I can get both of those things. But when I get them separately, I don't feel like I am losing anything. But I also want to name that when we, Dan and I, are talking about the internet, it's not entirely an individualized conception. We are our involvement with Judaism on the internet, it wouldn't quite be meaningless or nothingness if there was not community, but it would be way less. And what we're playing with is not merely like each of us at our screens doing stuff digitally that is Jewish, but actually doing it in interaction with other folks. And so that's what we're getting at. But I think that it's important to name the different ways that we conceptualize community and the different ways in which we may or may not need communities of Jews. Because I look back at my own, you've talked about your family a little bit. My grandparents and my great-grandparents were also ardent secularists. My great-grandfather grew up and learned the Talmud backwards and forwards from his father and rejected it pretty much wholesale. Knew it better than many Orthodox Jews in his area, to the point that they would come to him with questions in the early 20th century, but had no interest in it, and raised his son, my grandfather, to really not feel much of a connection either, although also he knew much of the material. And so I have this one side of my family that was staunchly Jewish in the communal sense. They were the center of their Catskills town and hosted Passover Seder, and probably didn't even, maybe they had a Haggadah there. I could ask my mom, but it wasn't about God. It wasn't about, it was an excuse to have a meal with a bunch of other people that were Jews. And I find that, whether it's my generation or it's something about me or whatever, I just have something different in me where I don't get the same vitamins from like being in Jewish community that add to the experience that distinguishes it from being with any community. And so that's why when I look towards Judaism, it has to have something for me that like exists, that I could be, to use an earlier episode, that I could be on a desert island. We just spoke with somebody about God on a desert island or Judaism on a desert island, that I could be there and still find something. I guess I'd love to hear from you, given that it does feel like your initial instinct is much more towards the communal, in the balance of things. We both value community, we both value individual experience. It feels like your instinct is more of a tilt towards the communal than the individual. What would it be, not to have an exclusively individual cultural Judaism, but what would something look like whereby the trends in our society generally towards personal meditation, towards mindfulness, towards individual stuff, what would that look like? Or maybe what does it already look like in a secular, humanistic, Jewish valence?
My colleague, Rabbi Denise Handlarsky in Toronto, has started a virtual synagogue, a virtual secular synagogue. She's really interested in creating this kind of availability of Jewish life to people who are not, who don't want to come to something. You don't want to leave home and come to something and be with people that they don't necessarily know, but they want to have this kind of secular cultural Jewish meaning in their life. I have never in my life thought about being Jewish on a desert island. But I think the idea of a virtual community certainly has merit. I mean, I think you can be close to people that you have not meet. And I've experienced that myself. I think it's a reasonable alternative, and maybe it's the wave of the future.
There is a premise, I think, that I've got on my mind, right, that I'm like sort of trying to float, because it's sort of what I'm looking for, right? Like, I'm looking for a secular Judaism that feels thick to me, that feels moving to me, that feels like a ritual to me, right? That feels like it shapes my life. And I haven't found that yet, right? You know, the only way that I found it is in these kinds of conversations, right? Or conversations with Lex or with others where we're grappling towards it. So in a way, the premise that I'm sort of trying to put out there is to say that I feel like those who are bravely saying that we are secular Jews, right? That we are atheists or some kind of close thing to atheist. I often say to people, I don't think I'm an atheist because I'm not sure there's no God, but I also wouldn't say I'm an agnostic because I'm pretty sure. But I don't feel like we've got it. You know, I don't feel like we've developed the alternative. And I feel like that's fine. That shouldn't be expected, right? You know, that this is, on the one hand, not new, as you say, but on the other hand, it's new in the sense of living in a society like America, an open society. It's new in the sense of our geographical dispersal. It's new in the sense of the open borders of who is a Jew and the potential that the peoplehood dimension becomes less powerful. And so I'm looking for this capacity to sit with others. And to, you know, I think the thing that I worry about the most is not so much that ultimately we're dispersed in a way that doesn't allow us to live Jewish lives in a compelling way. I'm more concerned that we're dispersed in such a way that we don't have the Yavne, right? That collection of rabbis at the, you know, at a previous time in which we were moving from one form of Judaism to another, where those who were working on the project could sit together and share notes and challenge each other to do better and to try other things. And that's the piece that I'm worried about, a kind of a secular triumphalism that's analogous to the theistic triumphalism, right? That says, we've got it, you know, and you know, right? And instead, what would it look like to have a more, I guess for me, from a scientific background, it's more like, what would it look like to declare that this, at least this next iteration, or this, not the next iteration, but what would it look like to declare that we're in a time of wandering in the wilderness, and this is kind of a time of experimentation and of not knowing and not being sure and sort of playing around with it? And that's where, like, I'm interested in the question of not so much what is an alternative ritual that I might be able to do for this holiday that somebody has already invented, but what are the components that I might be able to sort of remix in a different way that have always been part of it? So just as an example, I thought it was really great in your book that you identified, and I think you're not the originator of this, but you identified the sort of six elements that potentially go into any given holiday. And that, you know, perhaps in the last iteration, the God part was emphasized the most. And maybe in the next iteration, we might de-emphasize the God part and emphasize a different part. And I'm wondering, I think it might be helpful to our listeners to sort of give a few examples and think a little bit about some of the holidays or potentially other elements of Jewish life that people know about, life cycle rituals, et cetera, and to say, well, what does it look like when we sort of recognize that the God element has always only been one out of six parts of this, and this other element that might have been small in the past can be larger, and it actually can give it more meaning rather than less?
This is really important what you ask, because you are giving voice to what to the creativity of the Jewish experience, the idea that there's so much there that you can find what's meaningful for you. And that's really important to me, because if what you're interested in is nature, then you can look at the seasonal aspect of the holiday. If what you're interested in is history, then you can look at the historical aspect of the holiday. If you're interested in ethics, you can look at what this holiday is meant to teach you, or what you can take from it that, that nobody else has taken from it before. If you're interested in the national aspect of it, if you're interested in Israel, there will be a connection to Judaism as a political entity. If you're willing to look at all of these elements of the different holidays, you pick the ones that are meaningful for you, and you draw from that what you can do on that holiday and what this holiday means to you. And it doesn't have to be the same thing every year. There are so many themes in our holidays. We're lucky to have a culture that's, you know, been on six continents. It's been around for 3,500 years. There's a lot there that you can find and develop. And we don't have just the responsibility to learn from our history. We also have the responsibility to add to our history, to become part of the flowering of Jewish culture.
So just as we close out, are there any parting thoughts that you want to leave our listeners with before they head off to whatever's next, making dinner, getting out of their car after listening, whatever it is?
I do want to say that people are looking for authenticity. They want to be authentically themselves and authentically Jewish. My mission is to let people know that if they're not religious, they can still be Jewish, they can still be authentically themselves, and that there are places that they can express their authentic Jewish selves.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And thanks also, of course, to all of you out there listening. We want to close out this episode in the same way that we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to Twitter at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we like to make is that you can always support us with a financial donation, either on a one-time basis or a monthly recurring basis. And you can do either of those by heading to judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.